This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I bring you a taste of what's new in my world and then interview inspiring people in the food industry who work behind the scenes. We find out what they do, their road to success, and you'll learn about some jobs you probably have never heard of. Today, my guests include a talented chef who's closing her restaurant after 17 years. The woman responsible for some of the most incredible experiences at the number one restaurant in the world, as well as a scene maker and a scene stealer who created an incredible restaurant group in Hong Kong. So on Monday night, I was invited to a celebration of Anissa. Anissa is a beautiful small restaurant on Barrow Street that Chef Anita Lowe created 17 years ago. The event that I was invited to was a selection of Anita's greatest hits cooked by five of her legendary sous chefs. Why is that? Why that meal? Because Anissa is closing. And I wanted to take this moment to talk to Anita about the incredible restaurant that she created and some of the lasting lessons from her time there. So, Anita, welcome. I'm so excited to have you on Speaking Broadly.
Thanks, Dana. Thanks for having me.
I remember when Anissa first opened, and you had an incredible female power team. It was you and Jennifer Schism. Is that how you pronounce her name? And an all-female producer wine list.
Yes,
that was that was more than a decade before the Gods of Food piece in Time magazine that really blew the lid off the whole gender conversation. And I wanted to talk about gender and restaurants back then. Like, what were you thinking when you put together that list? What was on your mind?
I think I grew up in a feminist household. My mother was a doctor before. She was one of the very few female doctors in the country at the time. But she was certainly the only female doctor. And actually, she was actually the only female doctor in her hospital and also the only person of color on the doctor's team. You know, I've always been hyper aware of issues revolving around women. And so when we started our restaurant, we were actually just doing that list off of the name, because Anissa means women in Arabic, so we thought it would be cool to celebrate women in wine.
So are there some female producers who you've had on your list since the beginning who you want to give a shout-out to, who you just love so much?
Oh, gosh, there have been so many. Sue Juan Newton, Janet Trefethen, Ariana Okipinti. Gosh, I mean, yeah. You could keep on going.
I think what's great about the list is when you started, you did indeed call attention to the fact that they were all women. It is now and was then always an incredibly strong list. Like, it was, the wines were fantastic, and it was almost a shame to, you know, even have to point out that they were all women. But I think that you were also sort of doing a bit of service in doing so and in bringing to light these women who, we're just making great wine and needed to be recognized. I feel like you've been an incredible mentor. You've been great at recognizing talent in others. And one of the things about the dinner on Monday night was the team of cooks who prepared that meal. And they had all worked for you, and they clearly love you so much. And you had said how, you know, you didn't have kids, and so this was really, these cooks were your family. One of the chefs said that, you know, you allowed her or taught her how to be tough in the kitchen. What did she mean by that?
I'm not quite sure, but, you know, I think your stereotypical gender roles don't necessarily allow you to be tough as a woman.
So how tough were you, Anita?
I think I've always been, you know, exacting. I always try to be reasonable, and I always try to be kind. But at the same time, I think you know, we're trying to run a business, and we're trying to do things in a certain way and make things as perfect as possible. And you have to maintain standards. So, I mean, hopefully that's what she meant. maybe I was a jerk. I don't remember.
Sure, you're giving license to an entire group of people to just be jerks. I think that wasn't what she meant. And the other thing that to a last person they said was you had taught them every foundational thing they know about cooking in the kitchen. You were their first chef, which I just found so moving to be called, you know, you are my first chef. What is it that you think that you taught them that was foundational that they, you know, bring on for the rest of their careers?
I don't know. I think it's something that's being handed down from generation to generation. I mean, David Boulay was my first chef, and I just remember, you know, we didn't have any. My father died when I was really young, and I grew up with my stepfather, but he wasn't a very good father figure. You know, so I just remember being like 21 years old and working in the kitchen and feeling like that was such a strong role model for me, like having a chef, you know, that my chef. And I'm sure that, you know, I guess that's probably how he felt. I don't know. I mean, I think I can't speak for him. But the thing is about kitchens is that they're all encompassing. You really spend a lot of time there, and it does become its own little microcosm of a family.
Right. Well, I love what came out of your kitchen, of course. You know, there's the talent at the stove, and then there's the food that you created. I love the way your food crosses boundaries, you know, borrowing from Lebanon or Japan or Spain. And you did that long before and more elegantly than other people. I'm wondering, as that idea of, you know, borrowing from other cultures has landed so squarely on the plate today, whether there are other trends that you see going forward that interests you or what you think is ahead.
New trends. I mean, there's always, I'm fascinated by, I mean, this is not a new trend by any means, but and clearly, you know, this is very, very old on some level, but, you know, Israeli cuisine is hot right now. I went to Israel with Adina Sussman and Jen Lewis and Marco Canora a couple of years ago, and that was amazing. I love seeing how there's a light being shown on that, and I love how a lot of people are representing how multicultural Israel as a country is.
That's such an interesting point, because I think for the longest time we thought it was, you know, just something singular. And now, as with all cuisines that I've seen, you know, first you just see it's called Chinese food, and then you get into the regional distinctions, or it's, you know, Japanese food. And then the evolution of cuisine is always digging into the complexity and going deeper and understanding the nuance. And I think we are at such an interesting point with Israeli cuisine in that way. Well, I know that that ties into one of your great passions, which is travel. And I know that as you take a break, this well-deserved break, travel will be in your plans. So I look forward to hearing from you from the road and, you know, keeping track of you on your next adventures. I'm all for, you know, breaking with the past and launching into new adventures. So after you close this Saturday, I can't wait to see what it is that you do next. So thank you so much for coming on to Speaking Broadly.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks. My next guest is Natasha McIrvin. I'm excited to have her here because she creates some extraordinary experiences at some of the best known places, I would say, in New York, in the country, and now the world. And that is because she works with 11 Madison Park, Made Nice, and The Nomad. Welcome, Natasha.
Thank you. I am so excited to be on the show right now. So thank you so much for having me.
You have a crazy title. Your title is Director of Creative Projects.
Yes.
I like the idea that you're a director at, like, you know, 26 plus 368 days or whatever.
Right.
You're like nearly 27. But
yes.
Because you're in charge of so many things that go into making those restaurants very special. Can you just describe what it is that you have created your work to be? Because I think, you know, it didn't exist before you.
Right. You know, I think there's kind of a story into how this title and this position came to be, and we can get to that. But I mean, currently, what I do, it's a whole slew of things. It's anything from helping to establish dining room floor plans for, you know, future restaurants, or working for the design of a new credenza.
That's pretty disparate.
Yes.
Between credenza design. Do you have any background in credenza design?
Zero.
Okay.
I have none. Yes. And that's one thing about this job. It's very much kind of a, if you don't know how to do it, it doesn't really matter. You throw yourself at it anyways, and you learn along the way. And luckily, as much as I'm a creative person and I love to learn those things along the way, there's a great support system at the restaurants and other people that I can learn from and ask questions. So it, you know, it evolves, and I have made several mistakes along the way as well. But
okay. Yeah. I mean, I always love mistakes. I wrote a whole book about mistakes. Like, what is your most flaming mistake that you learned from?
Gosh, I mean, right now, as we're in the process of working on the renovation, there have been several times.
So 11 yes. Madison Park, when does it close?
So we close on June 9th to the public, and we will be closed until towards the end of September as we undergo a full renovation. It's been kind of a long time coming. But
And you've been intimately involved in working on the renovation.
Very much so.
Oh, I want to hear all about it.
Yeah, I'm so excited. I mean, that room has very much become my home. I started working there at the end of 2010. So for me, there's something
okay,
about
20 years old. Did you skip college?
No. I did go straight from culinary school, from high school, culinary school, straight to EMP. I celebrated my 21st birthday actually by going to a beer happy hour at 11 Madison.
Oh my gosh.
And then continuing and coming here to Roberta's afterwards for dinner.
Roberta so often plays a role in people's lives.
Doesn't it?
It's amazing.
It's a very special place.
Okay, so the renovation, what's going to happen? And what did you get to do to help make that happen?
So when I first came back to the company, so while I started in 2010, I actually left for a year, which we'll get to, and came back in 2014. And my role when I started was project manager. So this was kind of the first project down the pipeline that I started working on. So it was very much, I was involved from the early phases to now where we have, you know, fully, you know, 100% design schematics and whatnot.
Okay, so can you, maybe you can't tell me, maybe it's too top secret, but are the colors going to change? You can have different types of chairs. Like, what's the aesthetic of the new EMP?
I mean, the colors are definitely going to change. There are going to be new chairs. Our current chairs and banquettes are a little bit worn after, you know, the years that we've had them. But one thing that's very special about that place is it's so unique. To me, that space is so New York. It has the soaring ceilings. It has those Art Deco elements that are so iconic. And we're lucky enough to be working with an architect, Brad Klopfel from Portland, who also has offices out here. And he was a longtime regular at the bar. So he loves the space as much as we do. And so he doesn't want to change it too much, which was very important to everyone like myself, have made that their home. So some of those Art Deco elements are still going to be there. I think for the long-standing regulars at 11 Madison, they're going to be happy to see those in the new version. But absolutely, I mean, we need new tables, new chairs. So there's going to be an aesthetic change for sure. I think we talk about making it more modern and timeless. We just signed another lease for 20 years.
Wow.
So we're very excited. But the restaurant needs to last that long, and we're looking for a look that's going to carry us through those next 20 years.
So I love one of the things you've done to celebrate in that space, which has now happened for the last time is the Derby Party.
Yes.
The Kentucky Derby Party, which is a sort of an entire afternoon party around a 2-minute event.
Exactly.
Which is an extraordinary ratio of time.
Yes.
Spent to time enjoyed. So what was your role in creating those derby parties? I feel like horse topiaries played a role.
Yes, very much so. That topiary is very dear to me. When I first did start at the restaurant in 2010, I started as a kitchen server at the very bottom. But one of the things that 11 Madison Park prides itself on is these programs of ownership. So we try and get employees involved in certain aspects of the guest experience, from coffee to tea.
That's so interesting. So, like, you could be one of many servers and you chose to be involved with the derby, but somebody else could be involved in, like,
the beer program. Yeah. Oh,
that's so cool.
Which is great, and I think it gives everyone, like it did for myself, a sense of belonging and purpose, and you feel like you're contributing to the betterment of the restaurant, which I was very excited about. So it was actually something when I started, the gentleman who was in charge of the derby before me was leaving, and so Will came up to me and asked if I would
be interested. So Will Cadera, who is one of the two co-owners of 11 Madison Park.
My boss.
Her boss. Hi, boss.
Hi, boss.
It came up to you.
Yes, and asked if I'd be interested in working on this project. Now, I had always been a creative person growing up, so I kind of threw myself at it. And I really, with these kinds of things, I really dig deep into Google. And I started researching what the Derby was about, because I had never been to Kentucky to see, I hadn't seen a horse race at all. I certainly hadn't been to see the Derby. So I wanted to find out about the traditions, food traditions, beverage traditions, aesthetically, what was the look we were going for. And so I had this idea where we were going to have grass all over the restaurant, and I wanted a giant horse topiary in the window. And I pitched that idea, and they said, okay, if you can make it happen, then great, this will be your project. And so it was. So I like to think that, you know, my job now, what I have, it's all thanks to that horse topiary.
You've ridden that horse into, I guess not the sunset exactly, but you also are involved with another party project there, which is the Masquerade Ball.
Correct.
So one thing that fascinates me is that Nomad and EMP, they're very controlled environments, and everyone pays such attention to detail, so you have the perfect experience. But parties are much more wild and loose. And so you've been involved both in the sort of the, I don't want to call it uptight, but let's call it the uptight side and the wild side.
Yes.
So talk about the Masquerade Party, and how do you balance, you know, this precision with sort of
this loose, alive
loose,
kind of feeling. Yeah. I mean, that definitely, that puts very nice language to the difference between 11 Madison Park and the Nomad. And certainly with the Masquerade Ball, there are so many moving parts. We take over the whole first floor of the hotel rooms and transform each room. So with that party, we have so many different people involved. And so it's kind of like that ownership thing that I was talking about, where you just have this idea and you give it to someone and let them run with it. And as a group, we're constantly convening and making sure we're going over all those details and nitpicking everything, because that's what we do.
So, well, but that's a strategy, nitpick.
Yes.
And so what were some of the things that you were excited about for the Nomad Masquerade Ball, which happens on New Year's Eve?
Halloween. We do have a New Year's Eve party
another dress-up occasion.
Yes. One of my very favorite experience was last year. The theme was kind of Paris, turn of the century, and having lived there, I kind of really, you know, put my all into this. And with all of the rooms upstairs, we wanted to have some kind of connective tissue between them all, and that was the hallway that you walk through as you're going to these different rooms. And so the idea was thrown out there that what if the hallway could look like a Parisian street?
Wow.
Which is tricky in a hotel room.
Seems hard.
But I had so much fun with it, and we put up window shutters over all of the artwork and changed the lights so that they look like street lamps, had some sound effects and vines kind of crawling all over. So for me, it was one of those things that really had, I don't know, an effect on the party, and I don't know that people could quite put their finger on it when they were walking through those halls, but for me it was something that was such a transformative element of that. And that's what I love about the Masquerade more than anything, is those spaces are so, they're truly transformed, and you're taken somewhere else, which is so lovely.
Now, is there a magician as part of that night?
There has been in the past. Dan White, who is our resident magician at the Nomad, who has his weekly performances, usually gets involved. Him, his company Theory 11, will usually have their magicians, whether it's a whole room dedicated to that magician or whether it's a roving magician. We always try and find ways to incorporate that.
How did a magician become part of the lore of this restaurant group?
You know, especially with the Nomad being more of that kind of loose and alive spirit, we're looking for ways to, and it also has so many different spaces. You have the main restaurant and you have the library and you have the bar, and then moving upstairs we have different rooms that are usually for conference rooms, but those can be kind of taken over, and we wanted to find ways to maximize those. So at first it was actually a room on the first floor that was a jazz night of sorts. And so it would be a once a week or, you know, twice a week kind of event where you'd buy tickets and come in and see these jazz singers. And then as soon as that kind of faded out, we were looking for the next thing. And we had been in touch with Dan White and his and Theory 11 from his experience working with us on the magic course at 11 Madison Park.
Yes. Because that's why I want to know, because you turned into a magician as a server.
That's true.
How hard is it to do card tricks as a server?
Oh my gosh, it's so hard. That was, for me, that was one thing that I will say in all of my experience certainly took me outside of my box.
Yes.
In many ways. Just for me, as I like to be very calculated, I like to be very organized and have my systems. And so for me, magic has never been something that's been alluring. I kind of write it off. Uh-huh. And so when we were told we're going to be working on this magic course based on the tradition of three card Monty in New York City, which is a big part of kind of New York street performances, if you could call it that, I was a bit taken aback. I was like, well, magic, really? Like, oh, I don't know. It just feels like so, it felt so corny to me. But working with Dan and his crew, they are so talented. And they trained us so well. And it was this whole course where you'd have a dessert in front of you and someone would come over and, you know, do this trick with cards. And then, you know, you would have your next course revealed by the card that you selected. So it was a pretty exciting experience. And for me, one of the things that was really rewarding about it was when we finally felt confident enough to do it and we were doing it for guests.
Yeah.
And just watching their reactions, the pure joy on people's faces and excitement when they saw that reveal and they were fooled, I guess. I can't find a better word. It was just so exciting for me to see that. And at that point, then you couldn't help but fall in love with it and really kind of get into the moment.
in some way, it's really the essence of the experience at all of the brands, right, within the Make It Nice, because you want to surprise and delight people, and a magic trick goes to the heart of it, and you have a server bringing you that experience, and you are in control of the surprise of the guest.
Yes.
Just the way if you have wet feet, you know, and someone overhears you have wet feet, then
You bring them slippers.
That's amazing. So that type of surprise and delight is quite different from what you found when you went to Paris and you were working at, was it Frenchie?
Frenchie.
At Frenchie.
Yes.
So can you talk about, you know, your journey through EMP to Frenchie and back? Like, what did you learn by completely changing your environment?
You know, when I was first at EMP for the first 3 years, it's a very intense environment. I love it, but it's very intense. You're constantly studying and being quizzed on wines and, you know, service and technique. And the mindset there, everyone is trying to advance to the next level, to the next level. And so I did that, and I rose to the top, which was the captain level, and then I was even dabbling in some management as well. And for me, I've always been an adventurous person and always wanted to travel. And so as much as I was loving, you know, the EMP experience, I was like, I need to get out of here. I need to do something. I need to move somewhere else. And for me, Paris was my first instinct, just because I had spoken French in high school and was comfortable with the language. So I just decided to kind of pull the trigger and make it happen. I'm so glad that I did, but I went over there without a job, without an apartment, without a bank account, any of these things, which I ended up...
Okay, was that a little scary?
Absolutely. Yes.
That sounds terrifying.
It was, but I mean, having worked at 11 Madison Park, and also, I think, just being raised the way I was, it was, you know, you will find something. It may not be what you had in mind going into it, but you will find something. And if you don't, what's the worst that's going to happen? You're going to come back having had a great trip to Paris.
That's such a great attitude.
Yeah. But that's my attitude now. I'm sure there were moments where you could have talked to me then, and I wouldn't have been so optimistic. Yeah, it was terrifying. I had some contacts and some interviews set up, but I had to go through that whole process of getting the visa and kind of finding my niche there. And luckily, I was absorbed into the Frenchie world, which is a wonderful place. If you're ever in Paris, please go.
I love Frenchie. But it's really different.
It is so different. It's you go from 11 Madison Park, where everyone is at the top of the game, their game. All of the sommeliers are studying for their advanced and masters, and it's that constant push. And it's also a big restaurant. There's 29 tables, to Frenchie, which is the size of, it's smaller than our service station in the restaurant. There are 12 tables.
Wow.
There were two of us working on the floor as opposed to 30.
And did you feel like, what a come down? I've been at the top of the world and now I'm sort of, you know, in a cafe.
You know, yeah, it wasn't so much that. For me, I didn't really care if I was in a cafe or a fine dining restaurant, as long as I was learning something and being challenged and kind of felt like I was shaping something. That was what was important to me. But I will say it was a big cultural change, not only culturally from U.S. culture to French culture, but also from a restaurant culture kind of standpoint, where, like I said, you have this, you know, intense experience at 11 Madison Park to something that is a little bit more lax, because that's just the French culture and that's the way that they approach their restaurant and their service as well. So the people that I was working with, I adored them, but it just wasn't the same kind of mentality. I mean, because there are only two of us in the dining room, you can't really advance that far.
Yeah.
So there wasn't
there
wasn't that kind of chain, you know, or that those kinds of similar goals.
Or you kind of have to recalibrate what ambition is.
Exactly.
Because ambition is going to be different if you don't have the steps laid out for
right.
you.
And for me too, I think, you know, just the French style of service is so different. I think people go into a French restaurant and have a different expectation of the meal.
And what's that expectation? I thought they're very picky.
I think it's what I found is that they weren't really looking for that kind of gracious, warm service. I felt like French people almost wanted to be treated a bit roughly and be told what to do and told that they can't have this. And, you know, the answer was no. Whereas at 11 Madison Park, we were never allowed to say the word no. You always
right.
had to find the yes in everything. So on one hand, it was very liberating to say no. but at the same time, because of my roots with 11 Madison Park, I wanted to make it happen for them. I wanted to make things possible. But I felt like there was a lot of pushback with that, both from the guests and, you know, whatnot. But
I guess it also shows you that there is more than one way, right? Because if you're completely indoctrinated in that EMP way, like, this is the only way. It's probably a great experience to say, it's not the only way.
Absolutely.
You know, and just to open your mind and eyes to other things. It might not be who you are,
right.
but it's definitely a sort of another expression. So I'm wondering, you've worked for some incredible mentors, and is there a piece of writing that inspires you that you would like to read?
I do have one with me. Now, this is not related to cooking exactly, but this is
no
actually
need.
A new mentor. This is coming from a new mentor in my life. She's my friend Ida. She's 66 years old, and she lives on the Upper East Side. She's wonderful. And I was with her on Sunday, and I noticed this hanging on her wall, and it was just one of those pieces that I don't know, I felt like it spoke to me. And
okay, how do you know Ida?
She is my stepmom's best friend's mother.
Okay, this is great.
Yes.
Please go ahead.
But she's wonderful, and this comes from her wall. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too, if you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk on one turn of pitch and toss, and lose and start again at your beginnings and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is all the earth and everything that's in it. And, which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Now, this is by Rudyard Kipling.
Oh.
I like to change the ending where it says you'll be a daughter or you'll be a woman, my daughter, but to each his own.
And why does that mean so much to you?
I think it's something that really kind of speaks to the idea of having this pursuit of perfection. I mean, I think a lot of this is unattainable in many ways, but it's that constant struggle for perfection and having that mindset of humility along the way. It's something that's devoid of showiness and glamour, and it's those old-fashioned virtues of strength and fortitude and always, you know, trying to make something happen despite the reality of the situation.
And I think that actually you just wrote out your job description.
Yeah.
So you work for Will Gadara and Jan Lehum, these extraordinary partners who are perfectionists.
Yes.
And you have your own world within their world. How is it to work with people who, or how do you have your voice heard when their voice must be so strong in your head?
Yeah, it's a challenge, or it has been a challenge, learning how to kind of work around that and with that. I think at first there was certainly a lot of pressure and fear. I think that you think that you have this idea of who they are because of their names. And, you know, when I first started at the company, Will Gadara and, you know, Daniel Hume, their names have such resonance. But the more that you get to spend time with them and speak to them, you feel a little bit more comfortable. And so for me, it was something that, I don't know, at first I would, you know, try and pitch an idea that they would like, knowing that they liked it, and kind of go along with that. I would, you know, start to learn the nuances of what they expected. Doing the first Kentucky Derby was very different from, you know, doing this past one, just because I kind of fully grasp, I think, what the expectation of that is. But the really beautiful thing about working with them is they're all about hiring people, not people for, you know, them. They don't want just employees. They don't want servers. And so I think when they hire you, and that was something that I came to realize, is by becoming a part of their team, they wanted me for a reason. It was because I have a voice and an opinion. And so there have been times where I've sat down with Will and he said, you know, no, but like, what do you really think? Like, tell me what your opinion is. Tell me like what you actually, not trying to, you know, guess about what my answer is going to be. I actually want to know what you think. And so for me, that was very exciting and honoring. And the more I kind of came to accept the fact that they actually wanted to hear my opinion, the more freely I gave it and tried to give it.
I think that it means that their hiring process must be really excellent, because you can't give that type of responsibility either to a server to, you know, take on something, or to anyone else, if you don't really deeply understand what they're about and what their strengths are and what they could bring. Because otherwise, you don't really want that. You know, you have to know you're going to want their opinion.
Yes.
Because otherwise, that would be kind of backfire on you.
Exactly.
And I would love to know, because they're, again, so they're terrific to work for, but they're guys. Is there a woman that you'd like to nominate for the Speaking Broadly Hall of Dames?
I would like to go so far as to nominate two women.
You go right ahead.
They are our dream weavers at 11 Madison Park. At the restaurant, we have this very unique position called dream weaver, and their job over the course of your meal is to make experiences happen for you that you would have never believed could happen. For example, like you mentioned, if you come in and your shoes are wet from the rain outside, we bring you slippers. We've created experiences where you go into the elevator and it's transformed into a spaceship.
Just randomly?
Well, there was always context, whether it was something that was mentioned or a joke that was said. We always try and make it intentional. For example, I was recently in at the restaurant with my grandparents, who are from Seattle, and my family. And the next day it was forecasted to rain. So on our way out, they gave us these umbrellas that were all customized and drawn on with the leaves. And it was a really magical moment, but it was so subtle and so perfect. And so the Dreamweavers are the ones that make it happen. So we have two, Emily Parkinson and Bridget Zhu, and both of them are an inspiration to me every single day. It is mind-boggling the things that they come up with, that they're able to do, you know, at the flip of a coin. They're just so resourceful and truly artists, and I'm inspired by them every day.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so, so much for joining me today. We're going to take a short commercial break, and when I come back, I'm going to have the extraordinary Lindsay Jiang with me. She is one of the co-founders of Yardbird in Hong Kong, a yakitori restaurant, izakaya, that is the talk of the city and the world. She came to New York City with her partner, Matt Abergel, and they did a few nights of dinners here, all sold out instantly, and we're going to get to go behind the scenes with her just after this break. Be right back.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and welcome back to Speaking Broadly. I am very excited to have my next guest. She is the co-founder and co-owner of Yardbird Sunday Grocery and Ronin. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Ronin.
Ronin.
Yeah.
In Hong Kong. You created an instant hit with a restaurant in Hong Kong, which alone, I think, seems like it's an extraordinary feat. But the fact that you and Matt are both from Canada, the fact that you were in Hong Kong but doing Japanese food, and the fact that you didn't choose the space because, like, it was the most trafficked area in the city, all make it even more extraordinary that you were such a huge success overnight. So I'd love to talk to you about this success story. How did you get that first burst of energy and just got everybody coming to this restaurant and talking about it?
I think, to be honest with you, having grown up in the hospitality industry and worked in it, and Matt also working in the industry for so long and coming from New York prior to moving to Hong Kong, we knew everything that we wanted to do and what we didn't want to do. So having always worked for someone else,
yep,
I wrote the business plan for 2 years while Matt was, like, the reason we went to Hong Kong while he was fulfilling that contract. And so by the time we opened, we knew exactly.
Okay, so what did you want to do and what did you want to avoid?
We wanted to do no reservations and we wanted to start.
Are you, like, the first no reservations in Hong Kong? And, like, did people hate you for it, or?
I mean, probably the first westernized restaurant, no reservations.
Oh, right.
Good, like, point. You know, there's the Dai Pai Dongs where they probably don't even have a phone number. to reserve. We also, there's no tipping culture. So coming from New York and knowing the hustle and the incentive that your floor staff need to provide good service, that's what we wanted to bring. So usually in Hong Kong, there's a 10% auto gratuity, and that 10% goes to the owner or whoever they want, however they want to use it, totally legal. In the U.S., you'd be class actioned immediately. Yeah. So we wanted to do no reservations, and we wanted to train the staff to have personality to engage with our customer instead of just being a robot order taker. And we wanted to train the local, not train, that sounds patronizing, but we wanted to educate the local diner that, you know, you can tip for service received and you can treat a server with respect, because Hong Kong is still a two-class system. And, you know, there's still the upper and lower class, and people still have maids. So it's service industry is still considered submissive. And so we wanted to bring, like, if you, this is a great example. I was at Nobu, Matt was at Masa, Natasha with EMP. Like, that's a glory job. If you're in New York in the service industry, like, you are proud of where you work. And we wanted to change that in Hong Kong. And the only way to do that was to hire people who had no experience. I'm talking like zero, never worked in a restaurant before.
Wow.
They maybe never even like went to college. These were like young kids, 18, 19 years old, who had no idea what they were doing. So we just trained them. Like, we trained them from ground zero. And everyone, wow, like you said, Natasha, you started at the bottom. Like, when I started at Nobu, I was a busser. And then a runner, and then you get tested and tested and tested till you're a floor captain. And then what do you do after that? And you just, you know, you have ambition, or you're comfortable because you're making a good amount of money. And that's basically what we were trying to achieve in Hong Kong.
And let's talk about the food, because there's great food, but in a really casual setting. And was that groundbreaking for Hong Kong as well?
I think so. One thing Nobu is still like my hero, and he actually came to Yardbird, which, like, I was almost in tears like the entire time he was there. He was like fine dining with no white tablecloth. That was sort of one of the things, the core values at Nobu. And we were like fine dining service, no tablecloth. House party.
You totally added house party,
right?
In there,
like,
right?
That's kind of who we are. And so I can't remember what your question was. The food. Go ahead. Remind me.
So I'm excited to talk about the food and the casual vibe.
Yes.
And the energy of that place.
Okay, so basically, we came both from very fine dining establishments. And on Sunday, which was our only day off, which is why we have a Sundays brand, we would always eat yakitori. Like, yakitori tato on 55th between 8th and 9th was like our staple.
We loved that
you couldn't make a reservation. After a while, we went so often that, like, we could call them and they would at least hold us the parts of the chicken that we wanted. But
great.
We were always willing to wait, you know, wait with a cocktail and an ice cold beer. And that was what we liked. And so really, it was a no brainer. We were like, we want to eat yakitori every day. We want to drink with our food. And we want to give the best service that I learned from Nobu. And Matt's going to apply the skill set that he took from Masa. And that's literally what we've done.
Now, you found a community really quickly, and that's because you activated on social so fast. What did you do? Like, how did you make that happen?
It's funny. Social media, I don't know. I mean, don't quote me on this, but I feel like it, like, really blew
up.
It's
going out in the airwaves. I don't have to quote you to be heard.
Right. Okay. So I'll take the hit. I feel like it first started just with press. And then people just found us. And to be very honest and not arrogant, but in 2011 in Hong Kong, there weren't that many restaurants like us.
Mm-hmm.
So we were setting the tone, and we were sort of pioneering this casual environment with high quality food and fun. In like, you could eat and drink and just have a good time, and it wasn't so transactional. And then I go off on these tangents and I'm completely lost.
Now that's, so I guess I have a follow-up question, because you have this sort of skateboard culture, the vibe, which translated to social, right, which helped broaden your audience. So people found you and you were able to create a community. And I feel like the community is the foundation of all of your projects now.
Yeah.
Right? You stand for something very specific. So
yes.
I almost feel like your restaurant and the three of them are in a way like a media brand, and now you've created a media brand. What do you think the relationship is between creating a restaurant and then creating a digital brand? Because you're Miss Bish. Miss Bish.
Yes. Okay, so now I understand. Now I remember the question. So Matt and I met when we were 17 working in a skate shop. So our entire idea of marketing was stickers and T-shirts. That's like still how skate, surf, snow culture markets, right? So that's what we did. We made stickers and we made T-shirts. And we had like our favorite, it was just so serendipitous in so many ways. Like our favorite skateboard brand, the guy who did their logo was a friend of a friend. So he did our logo for us, which was like, it was like me sitting here with you, you know, when you put your dreams into the universe and then they come back to you. It's absolutely surreal. And so then, having worked in the skate and snow industry in Canada, all of those people, you know, they moved to Vancouver and they started their own brands, and then they had to do production. So they ended up in China. And then Hong Kong is like the savior after being in the factories in China for like a week. So we became this cafeteria for like all the designers and product developers and like the pretty high up there people making decision on product for like Vans, Herschel Supply. Like the guys from Herschel, he was my boss at the skate shop.
No way. Yeah. Oh my God. That's totally amazing.
Like our network of friends were now entrepreneurs. We're doing business in China, and then we got to feed them. You know, and that's how Vans, that's how we have this relationship with Vans, who gives us shoes and did a collaboration with us. And we're going into LA next year. And
that's really big news.
That's really big news.
And what's the concept that you'll do in LA?
It's going to be, well, I'm not going to say this on the air because somebody might get mad at me, but we're calling it Bird Yard.
Okay.
So you can assume that the concept would be similar,
similar, yes,
to what we do. Yes.
Right. It's sort of upside down.
It's flipping
US, Hong
it.
Kong, flipping
it's,
the bird.
It's
Ooh.
Flipping the bird, a little bit.
That's good.
Yeah.
And so, is your goal to grow more brands? And what about Ms. Bish?
So Ms. Bish is a digital platform that focuses on strong female-driven content. And that is completely separate from the restaurants. But through my relationships that I've made through Yardbird is how I met my co-founders for Miss Bish, how I met my current boyfriend. You know, it's been literally, it's a magical place. Like, really, it has been. And so that's how SundaysGrocery.com, the editorial side, came to life, because I was simultaneously learning all of this digital content creation. And so then I was growing my communications team internally with the restaurants. And every time I learn something from each, I apply it to everything.
That seems like, talk about serendipity, that seems like such a productive, you know, two businesses to have simultaneously. One that's essentially a digital brand building itself, and a restaurant group that needs promotion, well, because of the way that they could feed each other literally.
And it's funny because now, as we're sitting here doing a podcast, you know, content is king. So we now organically have an agency within my restaurant communications team where we do content creation, social media management for other people, all friends and family, because at the end of the day, we want to make sure the brand DNA aligns and we're not promoting something that we ourselves wouldn't get behind. but it's been so positive for my team because I get to keep giving them new things and they get to keep getting, like, they keep learning. And that's, for me, like, the ultimate, being able to be a founder or an owner or a leader. The more I can step away and the more I can delegate and the more I don't have to make the decisions for things that I've previously made decisions on, that is success to me.
So I'm curious about your success with finding the boyfriend while your while your partner's your ex, well, your baby,
baby daddy. Baby daddy.
So you have what I would say is one of the most complex and right now peaceful collaborations between
my life.
Interested parties. So can you tell me, like, was it a struggle to start a business with Matt, who was your, you know, longtime partner, and you have two beautiful children with him, and then to break up that partnership, fall in love, you have an amazing boyfriend who also is part of the business. How hard was that?
It's so weird. You know how, well, as you get older, I'm going to cry because I'm older. No, just kidding. you realize how unless you take a leap and you know it's going to hurt and it's not going to be easy, would you rather be scared for a minute or be miserable forever? And Matt and I were best friends at 17 until we were like 23. And then we fell in love, actually, because we started working in a restaurant together. And then, you know, you have two kids and things change and hormones are crazy. And we were building a restaurant and we were in a new city. And then 6 months after, we opened in July and we separated in December. And I gotta say, like, for sure, the words, just saying the words, you know, you think them as women. We probably rehearse them in our minds for so long before they can actually be, like, falling out of our mouth.
What were the words?
Just, like, I don't think this is working. Like, we are not happy. And I think a lot of times, you know, and Matt will say, you know, you think you just, it's going to get better. And I did, too. But I was the one, like, I just had to make the call because we were destroying ourselves because we were both unhappy and it wasn't good. So we had this business that was just growing like crazy. We had two young children. And I think at the core, like, it was hard, you know, there was resentment, there was anger, there were moments where it was like, I did more than you and blah, 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 right? And then we finally, it took a long time. I would say in the last year and a half, it's been great. You know, he actually likes Alex, my new boyfriend, more than me most of the time. At the core, we're best friends. You know, like, at the end of the day, you know, we still say, I love you. We co-parent. You know, we hang out. We all hang out. I still talk to his parents, you know, like, there's very much, we're a modern family, period.
What do you think the key to that is?
You know, people literally ask me, they're like, I don't understand, like, I hate my ex and da 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 da. And I think that we have true love for each other and true respect. And it's taken a long time to realize that we need each other to be successful, especially in the restaurant space. And we've given each other freedom to do other things. Like, he's not mad at me doing Miss Bish. And I'm not mad at him, you know, what projects he's doing. And I don't feel like I own him. And we actually, we get such joy, like, when we get to do these pop-ups. And we see that what we've built can translate to other places. There's nothing like that feeling of, like, being like, this is what we've done together.
That's so great. I wonder, in stalking you on social, I've seen your extraordinary yoginess.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I've done yoga for also more than half my life now.
Do you think that your yoga practice in any way has informed or influenced your ability to flow and the way that you have or make the hard decisions you have?
Like 100%, which is something my 6-year-old would say. For sure. Like I was lucky enough, you know, you practice yoga, but really you got to find a teacher. You have to find a mentor. And I found one in Hong Kong, ironically, who was the most generous soul I've ever met, who didn't keep any secrets, who wasn't competitive, who wanted you to be better than him. And I learned, all I learned from practice and practice and physical practice and not from like BS spiritual talk was that if you can live without ego and be humble, truly, then like you're at peace, you know, like I'm not, I feel like I, if I can just be happy for everybody else and be a nice person. And, you know, Matt's mom, who's really like a mom to me too, she told me once, cause she is also a very selfless person, and I'm not going to claim to be non-selfish because obviously there's selfish parts of me. She said to me once, you know, the best thing her father ever said to her was, if you can do something for someone else, anything, small, big, pick up that water, go pick up groceries for me, do it. If you have the time, do it. Like, there's no, just be generous with your time and your energy. And that's what I remind myself every single day to do.
That is the most beautiful expression I've got, like, jerk here. And with that thought, that wraps up today's Speaking Broadly. Thank you, listeners, so much for being with us today. Thank you to my awesome, incredible engineer, David Tatasciore. And come back and listen again next week. This is Dana Cowan for Speaking Broadly. Actually, I want the two of you to share your Instagram handles and where we can find you. So I'll start. I'm Dana Cowan. You can find me at FW Scout and also at Speaking Broadly. And Natasha?
So I just have one Instagram. It's at Natasha_McIrvin, McIrvin.
I'm at Lindsay Jang, LindsayJang. And then instead of wasting your time, if you go to that, you'll see all of my other things that are going on my profile.
Right. So you can learn about what's going on at the restaurants. And Lindsay's own Instagram is really personal and beautiful, but and has a very different point of view from the restaurants, which you can link to from there. So that's it. Have a great week. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.